the line from an old 20th century movie. Adapt, improvise, overcome. An evil smile spread across the first sergeant's face.
Hey, Jackson, how much CS6 you got?
The situation was becoming desperate. Tim's laser wound may have been cauterized neatly by the immense heat of the laser round, but the man was rapidly going under shock.
Tim! Tim, stay with me!
Alistair shouted, as Tim's head lolled once more and his eyes rolled up into the back of his head. The doorway the two scorpions had sought refuge in was now pockmarked and blackened by repeated impacts from the Javul rifle fire and the occasional hit from the Lumar security guards, whose reinforcements had been arriving at a steady trickle, which was rapidly turning into a deluge.
If they have any common sense and tactical awareness, they'll seal the entire level and send in enough men and equipment to overwhelm the Javul,
Alistair said, as a maudlin chuckle escaped him. Another burst of laser fire struck the edge of the doorway, forcing him to hunch over the now unconscious Tim to protect him, as bright sparks flew in every direction. Without warning, the sheet metal door Alistair was leaning against flew to one side, and he fell backward flat onto his back, his head striking the unyielding floor with a bang, sending stars spiraling across his vision. Instinctively, his pistol flew up, ready to engage the new threat, only for his arm to be grasped in a strong, vice-like grip.
"Easy there, Colonel," said Kroll,
as he released Alistair's arm, while keeping a wary eye on the flechette pistol in the colonel's hand. A sense of relief filled Alistair, as a wide grin spread across his face at the sight of the first sergeant.
"What took you so long?" "Traffic's a bitch today, sir," replied Kroll,
looking across to where Jackson was giving Tim a brief but thorough examination. The trooper slipped a hypo spray from the med pouch on his combat rig and pressed against the captain's neck. Swiftly checking the man's vitals again, he gave a thumbs up to Kroll.
"I'll need to carry him, but we're good to go. Nothing here that a night in the med bay can't fix."
Kroll fixed Alistair with an assessing eye.
"Can you move on your own, sir?"
Alistair rolled to his feet, shaking the last few stars from his vision, before checking the load on his pistol. Under half a magazine left.
"Jackson! Give your weapon to the colonel," ordered Kroll.
In one deft movement, the trooper unclipped his rifle and passed it over.
"Locked and loaded, sir."
Alistair hefted the rifle in his hands, briefly checking the fire selector was on 3-round bursts, before replying to Kroll's question.
"Now I'm ready to go."
With Kroll's help, Jackson lifted Tim's limp body over his shoulder.
"Okay. Let's get the hell out of here."
It only occurred to Alistair then that he had not asked how the first sergeant and Jackson had managed to reach him. The answer was the jagged hole in the side of the storage room and the corresponding hole in the wall of the neighboring storage facility, which opened onto the service corridor and the end run to the docking bay and the waiting dropship. The sound of rifle and pistol fire retreated into the distance, as Alistair and his small party raced along empty corridors, through the service door into the bay, and up the ramp of the dropship, whose pilots did not even wait for their passengers to get seated or for the ramp to lock into place before applying power and heading for the bay's outer doors, which opened at a command from Corporal Okoro's hacking program. Clear to navigate, the dropship boosted for the Glambring, waiting a few hundred miles away.
"Contact the Glambring," Alistair ordered Okoro. "Tell them we have wounded and..."
Alistair's eyes fell to the prone, lifeless figure of Trooper Terhune, covered by the only thing Okoro had on hand, a dusty and tattered cargo tarpaulin. Alistair's stomach hardened, and a lump formed in his throat.
"And one fatality."
Alistair forced his gaze away from Terhune's body and retrieved his slate from his pocket. At some point during his and Tim's escape, the information download had completed. Closing his eyes, He brought up the file index via his pinplants, and the true extent of the amount of information was simply staggering. It would take weeks to go through it all, and Alistair had no idea why Dirall had entrusted him with it. Perhaps the Flatar knew he was dying, and it was a final one-digit act of defiance. Who knew? At the head of the index, a single file was highlighted. Cathal. Alistair opened the file and began reading the summary. Having read it once, he read it again, before letting out a low whistle. In the seat opposite, Kroll gave the colonel an inquisitive look, to which Alistair replied with a weak smile.
It looks like Terhun's sacrifice may not have been in vain.
When Alistair did not expand any further, Kroll decided not to push it. Advantageously, a call from the pilot forestalled any awkward questions.
Colonel, the Glambring is already underway, and we are accelerating to catch up with her. Captain Kothu reports that he has secured early departure through the Stargate. Looks like he wants to put Rala Station behind us.
Him and me both, replied Alistair.
Tim Buchanan opened his eyes with a trepidation that someone who has skirted death on too many occasions tends to. One day those eyes might open to reveal a place of either wonder and everlasting joy, or, more likely, in Tim's occupation as a mercenary, never-ending fire and brimstone. As Tim's eyes revealed his surroundings, it appeared he had cheated death one more time. Unless, of course, Hell had a room especially put aside for him that was an exact duplicate of the Glambring sickbay. The noise of gentle snoring penetrated his pondering, and he rolled his head in the direction of the sound, and for a second, Tim did question his surroundings. For there, curled in a chair with a blanket draped over her, was a sleeping, soundly Anna May Wong. As if aware of his scrutiny, Anna awoke, her jade-green eyes focusing on him, as a slow smile formed on her lips.
"Finally awake, sleepyhead," Anna said softly.
Her tenderness confused him. He felt as though this was the first time he had seen or heard her. No shouting, no arguing, no swapping insults. Opening his mouth to reply, Tim's throat felt as though he had gargled dry desert sand. A water bottle on the bedside table caught his attention. Without thought, he reached for it with his right hand. He grunted loudly as the wound he had sustained from the Javul laser round reminded him of its presence. Seeing what he reached for, Anna uncurled from the chair as elegantly as a ballet dancer and scooped up the water bottle and offered the straw to Tim's dry lips and parched throat.
"The doc says the wound was a lot worse than we first thought. It didn't just burn away the outer dermis. It flash-burned the underlying muscle and a part of the bone. Not to worry, though. Your nanites, with a little help from the dock and a sprinkling of fairy dust, will have you good as new in a few days. A week, tops."
Anna graced him with a blinding smile, and he nearly gagged on the water at how attracted to her he was.
Oh, Christ. Could Alistair have been right when he pointed out that they each had feelings for each other? Surely not. But how can he explain the tingling in his hands and the lightness in his limbs? Must be the painkillers, thought Tim.
With the water came the ability to speak, and Tim asked the question burning deep in him.
Why?
Anna gave him a blank look.
Why? Oh, why are you here? I told you, the Javul laser.
Anna stopped as Tim shook his head.
No, Tim said. Why are you here? You hate me.
A gurgling laugh escaped her perfect lips.
Ate you?
Another laugh.
Oh, you silly man. I think I love you.
Tim's mouth dropped open slackly. Words that made no sense came bubbling out.
But you, I, we...
Ah, I see you are awake, Tim,
called Alastair Sinclair, as he walked into the room, reining himself to a stop, as he noticed the interaction between Anna and Tim.
Perhaps I should come back later,
Alastair said hurriedly.
No need, Connor, said Anna. I'm just leaving.
Turning to Tim, she planted a gentle kiss on his forehead.
We shall finish this conversation later, Captain Buchanan.
And with that, she skipped out of sickbay. Tim was at a complete loss for words as he ran his left hand through his short hair, slowly shaking his head. A deeper laugh now filled the room, as Alastair enjoyed the confusion of his friend.
If you think that was strange, be grateful you were out of it when we docked the dropship. The airlock was hardly open when she came through it like a Tasmanian devil. I think Kroll still has the bruises, and poor Tula was lucky not to be stood on. When the good doctor saw the body of Terhun, she thought it was you, and I swear I have never heard a wail like it. I thought the witches from Macbeth had descended upon us. When Jackson lifted you out of your seat, she was on top of you and hanging on like a mama bear. It took two of us to get her to let go, so the medics could haul you off to sickbay. And she's been camped out here for 2 days, refusing to leave. I'll say one thing for her. She is one bloody-minded woman when she wants to be.
Alastair's short laugh filled the room for a second time.
You've got your hands full there, Tim Buchanan. No doubt in that. Even Corporal Vega decided it was more than his life was worth to get between the pair of you. He's been living in the corridor outside.
Tim was completely baffled by the turn of events, and Alastair could see that he was losing him, so snapped him back to reality.
We need to bring you up to speed, as we are already...
Alastair checked the ship's chrono.
51 hours into our journey to Cathal.
Who or what is Cathal?
Asked Tim, bringing himself back to the business at hand.
Cathal is, or rather was, a red diamond mine. It's a fairly large moon, one of seven, in orbit around a gas giant in an otherwise obscure system in the Tolo Arm. The atmosphere is breathable with the aid of rebreathers for a limited time, but too long, and the skin absorbs the nitrogen-rich atmosphere, and it eventually replaces the oxygen in the bloodstream. It's what the old deep-water divers called the bends. Not a nice way to go.
And why are we headed there?
Tell me that little rodent Dirol is not sending us on a wild goose chase, said Tim. On the contrary, replied Alastair. According to his files, which admittedly are not overflowing with details, the mine was closed down in a hurry when the Karun who operated the mine were forced out by none other than our friend, General Peepo, when they discovered an ancient dustman facility. Rumor has it was an energy research facility, one which built power sources for Ragnar.
Rumors are one thing, Tim said,
flapping a hand dismissively.
How many times have we come across so-called Dusman artifacts, only for them to turn out to be fakes? I would agree with you, except for one thing,
Alastair said as he looked Tim directly in the eye.
Would you guard a rumor with a battalion of Besquith and declare a no-fly zone within 5,000 miles of the moon?
Chapter 12 heave to for inspection. The fleeting moment of falling vanished nearly before Charlie Sinclair realized it was upon him.
Damn. You would think after years of travel in the universe I would get used to translation.
In the seat beside him, Lieutenant Tori MacDonald was sitting with her eyes closed as the last flutters left her stomach.
You and me both, Major,
she said, sotto voce. Packed into the too small cargo pod which had been hastily converted by the Zuparty crew of the Talakoz, the men and women of 1st Platoon Gamma Company, Sinclair Scorpions, were mumbling and joking among themselves. Charlie was sure that on the opposite side of the tramp freighter, 2nd Lieutenant Stacy Kamala and the members of 2nd Platoon were doing the exact same thing. If Kamala was suffering any side effects from the transition from hyperspace to normal space, Charlie was willing to bet his last credit that she was doing her damnedest to hide it from Sergeant Deacon. The senior NCO had stepped up to fill the first sergeant post left vacant because 1st Sergeant Kroll had returned to Earth along with Tim Buchanan, Charlie's second in command, to brief Alastair Sinclair directly. Now that all hell had broken loose on Earth after Peepo's invasion, their whereabouts were unknown. The half-strangled buzzing of the intership collar mounted on the grime-streaked wall galvanized Charlie into motion.
How the hell anything on this tub worked will never cease to amaze me, Charlie thought, as he slipped his seat restraints and half-bounced, half-floated over to the collar.
The Tla-Koz had carried virtually no Delta-V across from hyperspace, meaning that she was crawling clear of the emergence point. This was not unusual, as it was expensive in reaction mass, and therefore cost, to dump speed and alter course. So some ship's captains preferred to come through emergence points at the lowest navigable speed. Charlie tapped the accept key, but before he could speak, the excited voice of the Zuparty ship's captain exploded out of the speaker.
I wish to renegotiate our contract, human.
Charlie tried to disguise his surprise by asking a simple question.
Why?
The Zuparty rushed on dismissively.
It is of no importance, human. I am willing to make you a generous offer if you expand our simple transportation contract to one covering anti-piracy operations.
Well, what you ask is not something we specialize in, said Charlie,
stalling for time as he sent a message to Tori via his pin plants.
There is something up. The captain wants to employ us, and he is in a hurry to do so. Check the ship's sensors.
Tori was sitting in her acceleration couch when she got Charlie's message. It was a matter of moments to access the ship's systems, as the run-down protective firewalls matched the condition of the rest of the ship. The freighter did not have the best sensor suite in the world, but she could not help noticing the pair of radar returns that were closing in on the Talakoz. Small and nimble, they screamed pirate. Tori shot the feed over to Charlie, who gave a grunt of acknowledgement.
Your sudden offer would not have anything to do with a pair of vessels that are closing in on us, would it?
Asked Charlie of the Zuparty, his voice dripping with sarcasm. The silence on the other end of the line was all the answer Charlie needed.
Very well, Captain. Consider our contract expanded.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, gushed the Captain.
Don't thank me yet, Captain, said Charlie. My payment shall be transport for myself, my men, and all our equipment back to Earth.
That is outrageous,
bellowed the Zuparty.
The cost in F-11 alone, never mind the lost revenue in missed completion times,
will all be covered by my company on our safe arrival at Earth, reassured Charlie.
Once more the line fell silent.
The clock is ticking, Captain, and those two pirate ships are getting closer.
Very well, human. You have a deal.
A wise decision, Captain.
Now, do exactly as the pirates tell you, and leave the rest up to us.
Without waiting for a reply, Charlie terminated the call and spun to face the expectant face of Tori MacDonald.
Break out the small arms and pressure suits, and let's get ready to give our unexpected visitors the sort of reception they deserve.
What about the two pirate vessels? Even if we take care of their boarding party, they could simply pull away to a safe distance and blast the crap out of us.
Charlie paused. Tory had a point, and then an evil grin split his face. The grin, Tory instantly recognized, meant Charlie had settled on one of his impulsive and madcap plans.
"We'll need a couple of anti-armor mines," Charlie said,
as he pulled his haptic suit from his deployment bag and stripped out of his ship suit while he spoke.
"Fancy a spacewalk, Lieutenant?"
15 minutes later, Charlie was still breathing hard from the mad rush to get his Mark 8 Casper out of its transit case and powered up. The Mark 8 may have been smaller than the Caspers that had preceded it, but it had a 50% greater endurance and a new modular system which made swapping out weapons and surveillance systems easy. It was a perfect fit for the Scorpion's deep reconnaissance work. The state-of-the-art suit was one which Alastair Sinclair had insisted was an investment well worth spending the small fortune each suit had cost the Scorpions. The speed at which Charlie had been able to bring it online and ready for action justified the expense to Charlie. Calming his breathing, he double-checked his suit's power emissions were as low as he dared, just enough for life support, heating, and basic suit functions. Perched where he was on the outer hull of the Tlacoz, held in place by magnetic boot clamps, Charlie watched the approaching pirate ship close with the Zupardi freighter's bow airlock. A command to the suit caused his Tri-V display to split and show the view from Tory MacDonald on the stern. The second pirate vessel was making its own approach to the rear airlock. Charlie replayed the sole message the pirates had transmitted. No video. Audio only. "Zupardi freighter, cut your engines and prepare for boarding. Do not resist. Anyone who deviates from my orders will be immediately executed. We only want your cargo. Once we have it, you will be free to go. You have my word."
A pirate's word indeed,
thought Charlie, as he watched the two small craft close.
No way they were big enough to handle the amount of cargo the freighter was carrying. And the Zupardi captain was smart enough to know it, or he would not have come to us for help.
The pirate ships changed course, angling for the bow and stern of the freighter.
Classic pincer maneuver,
thought Charlie. No doubt the pirates were going to go for the command deck and engineering as their first targets. Take those two areas, and you effectively controlled the ship. Any crew who were brave enough to put up a fight could be sealed into whatever section they happened to be in, and that section opened to space. A grisly death, which Charlie did not think for a minute the pirates would lose any sleep over. Once they had secured the ship, the pirates had a range of choices. Sell off the cargo and ship, or ransom it back to the original owners. As for the crew, their fate was more uncertain. If the ship owners were inclined, they could pay a ransom to secure their employees' freedom, or, more likely, the crew would simply disappear into one of the myriad of slave markets scattered across the Galactic Union. For all its preaching about taking the high moral ground, slavery was still legal in many parts of the Union. A brief puff of maneuvering jets came from the closing pirate ship, slowing its approach to a bare crawl. Charlie activated his suit's LIDAR and allowed it a single scan over the ship. His suit's onboard computer ran the electronic image against its database and projected its assessment into Charlie's line of sight.
"Hey, Tory, looks like I got a converted Illac intersystem tug. Extra external reaction mass tanks and..."
Charlie double-checked the suit's assessment.
"A twin railgun mounted in a chin turret that looks like it was welded on by a blind man. Not a fantastic amount of firepower,
but enough to turn the Tlakals into a flying sieve. Clamped a few feet from the stern airlock, Tori MacDonald assessed her objective.
Same amateur night equipment here, Major. Computer is calling it a tugboat, which has been around longer than I think humanity has been out of our caves. This guy has a single fixed spinal laser, and with the power output of the tug's reactors, I think it's safe to say it's somewhere in the 10 to 20 megawatt range. Easily enough to punch through our ship's unarmored hull.
Tori's opinion was enough for Charlie to be confident his original plan was the correct choice. Switching across to the company command net, Charlie put in a call to Lieutenant Kamala and Sergeant Deacon.
Okay, guys, stick with the plan. Let them board. I only need a minute at most for Tori and I to do our thing.
From behind a sheet of replacement hull she was using as a makeshift barricade blocking the access corridor 20 feet from the bow airlock, a pressure-suited Stacy Kamala acknowledged Charlie's orders before switching channels and addressing the three troopers crouched beside her.
We let them board and advance to within a few feet of us. We need to give the Major and Lieutenant MacDonald as long as we can. So weapons tight until I give the order.
The corridor was simply too narrow for all the troopers of 2nd Platoon to fit into it, and Stacy had deployed the rest to a secondary barrier in case the pirates' boarding party were able to force their way past her. Sergeant Deacon had a similar block at the stern airlock, though he had deployed the remainder of 1st Platoon throughout the Tlacosa's engineering spaces, rather than at fixed defense points. A sound like a hammer hitting a bell was accompanied by a shudder that ran through every frame of the Tlacosa's hull as the pirate crews used magnetic clamps to secure themselves to the outer airlocks.
"Stand by," said Kamala,
settling her laser rifle into a more comfortable position. The smart tech of the weapon projected the aiming dot directly onto the faceplate of her lightweight pressure suit. There was no guarantee a random round from either side would not breach the ship's hull and cause decompression, so the Scorpions had opted to fight in pressure suits. If the pirates were not similarly equipped, then that was too bad for them. The telltale light above the airlock changed from red to green, and Kamala got her first view of the pirates as the heavy door swung to one side. Humanoid in appearance, but beanpole thin, with bulbous heads that made them a dead ringer for a child's stick drawing. Those heads had wraparound dark glass goggles, which completely covered their eyes, and oversized ears located on either side of those bulbous heads. Shortened arms held equally stumpy weapons. Rapid-fire laser carbines, each with a wicked-looking foot-long blade extending beyond the barrel. Each had an ill-fitting utility harness with a random assortment of pouches. There was no sign of body armor.
Shit,
thought Kamala.
Dragoons. Pirates by choice, and slavers for fun of it.
Four of the dragoons exited the airlock, heads moving from side to side warily as they scanned the corridor.
Probably looking for the captain who was meant to surrender himself to them on entry,
said one of her troopers helpfully.
Well, whatever is slowing them down is good news for the Major, replied Kamala,
praying the Dragoo would remain undecided for a few seconds longer. Deactivating the magnets holding him to the hull, Charlie applied a gentle amount of pressure to the Casper's suit jets and edged clear of the freighter's hull. Centering his vision on the Dragoo ship, he picked a spot near the rear of the tug where a large square of red was painted around a removable hull plate. If the Casper's computer was accurate, then that plate was the emergency plasma vent designed to blow off and allow superheated plasma to escape from the tug's reactor. The perfect place to deposit Charlie's little present. Ignoring the spinning stars that gave him vertigo, Charlie reoriented the Casper to allow him to land on the tug beside the red-edged plate feet first.
"Nice and gentle, Charlie,"
he said to himself.
"Let's not bounce off and have to go around for a second attempt. Sooner or later, those Dragoo are going to run out of patience and go looking for the crew."
As soon as his feet touched down, Charlie engaged the magnetic boots and moved on to the second step of his part of the plan. Reaching into the snap-on pouch attached to his leg with both hands, he felt for the twin handles of its contents. Finding them, he pulled the anti-armor mine clear of the pouch. Linking his suit to the mine's controls, he swiftly programmed it for remote detonation. The blinking red light went solid as the mine's tiny computer brain acknowledged the command. Satisfied the mine was ready for action, Charlie tethered it to his Casper, while his hands dipped into the pouch again, this time retrieving a can of adhesive. Bending at the waist and knees until he was just a few inches from the hull plate, Charlie sprayed an area roughly the size of the mine's diameter. The chemicals in the bright blue adhesive bonded at the molecular level with the hull. Untethering the mine, Charlie ensured he had pushed it down firmly into the adhesive, which bonded to the mine's casing in seconds. Stepping back, Charlie admired his handiwork before releasing his boot magnets and jetting back to the Tlacaz.
"Tori, I'm clear. How are you doing?"
"Heading back now, Major. The mine is armed and linked to your Casper's fire control."
"Understood."
Charlie switched to the company-wide frequency.
"All Scorpions, this is Scorpion Actual. Light them up." "All Scorpions, this is Scorpion Actual. Light them up."
With the Major's order resounding in her ear, Kamala squeezed the trigger of her rifle, sending enough energy to melt a steel plate into the chest of the Lee Dragoo. Although not as spectacular on impact as other weapons, the vaporization of the Dragoo's entire chest was, nonetheless, just as satisfying. Switching targets, she dropped another Dragoo, who was unlucky enough to be moving as Kamala's laser round struck, removing a goodly portion of his lower bowel, hip, and upper leg. A follow-up shot eased his pain forever. The fight for the bow airlock was over before the Dragoo even knew it had begun. However, the Dragoo aboard the tug must have been watching via remote surveillance because, without warning, the ship carried out an emergency breakaway maneuver which ripped the still-open airlock clean off its mounting, exposing the corridor to space. Air rushed out the tear with the force of a jet engine, pulling anything not tied down with it. Kamala was swept off her feet before she could activate her mag boots, only for the trooper beside her to wrap both arms around her floundering legs before she could be sucked into the depths of space.
"I've got you, sir,"
came the reassuring voice over her comm, over the sound of her racing heart. The screaming quickly dissipated as the air vented into space, leaving the corridor in silent vacuum. With the wild forces of decompression no longer pulling her, Kamala activated her mag boots and felt them reassuringly anchor her to the deck. Through the gaping rupture left in the Tlacaz's outer hull by the pirate's emergency undocking, Kamala watched as the pirate ship rapidly receded.
"Don't think you've got away, you bastards. A scorpion always has a sting in its tail."
"Safe distance achieved, Major Sinclair,"
said Charlie's Casper, as he continued to watch the pirate ship recede. Charlie, like many mercs, had programmed the suit to talk to him in a familiar voice, and his Casper's vocalization matched Mary's intonations precisely. Mary's calming inflections reassured and comforted him. She was never far away, no matter the distance which separated them when he took a contract. Perhaps strange to those who did not live the merc life, but Charlie equated the boost he got from listening to his Casper to that of an old-time soldier receiving a letter from his sweetheart before the advent of first contact. It reminded him that no matter where or what he fought, a pair of loving arms awaited his return.
"Keep going. Keep going. Take your medicine. Gather up your toys and go home to play another day," said Charlie to himself.
"Aspect change on both pirate ships, Major Sinclair. My sensors are detecting fire control radar. The ships are targeting us."
"Well, don't say I didn't give you a chance," Charlie said with an edge of disappointment. "Detonate the mines."
Traveling at the speed of light, the radio signal reached out from Charlie's Casper and was received at virtually the same instant by the mines placed by Tori and himself. 2 pounds of C-6 explosives warped the copper cone at the mine's base. The intense heat and explosive force converted the copper into a stream of superheated plasma, which cut through the pirate's hull like a hot knife through butter. The plasma flashed through pipework and electrical conduits surrounding each ship's reactor core. The interaction of the plasma, the protective casing surrounding it, and the reactor's own mass was nothing short of cataclysmic. Charlie witnessed 2 new stars burn brightly in the night sky for a fraction of a second before the greedy nuclear blast ate its own mass and fizzled to an expanding cloud of gas and hard radiation. Charlie began to trudge back along the hull to the airlock, hoping there was not too much damage to the hull's integrity and that a makeshift airlock would be functional soon. The thought of having to evacuate a whole corridor to use as an airlock just seemed such a waste of resources.
"Major Sinclair, the captain is trying to contact you."
Charlie's face took on a pinched expression. The Zuparty probably wanted to haggle over the contract now that his ship had sustained damage, no matter how minor it was. No matter. Charlie would haggle over reparations. The important thing was he would hold the captain to his agreement to get Charlie and his troopers home, though Charlie wondered what to expect when he got there.
"Put him through."
Chapter 13 Old Friends. Alastair Sinclair perched on the jump seat, which had become his in all but name at the rear of the Glambrings Bridge, as the frigate made transition back into normal space. Immediately the sensors reached out, and the navigation and threat boards began registering contacts. The Scorpion's colonel had never pretended to be a naval man. He left that to people like the Glambrings' captain, Captain Cthu. However, he did know his way around a threat board and noted the bubbles superimposed around an area on a planetary object bearing the name Cathal. The tactical computer was calling it an overlapping group of fire control radars, which were capable of detecting any air or ground movement out to a range of 220 miles from the mine's main site, while the Glambrings radar picked up a number of satellites in geostationary orbit above the site. From their electronic emissions profile, a number were additional radar detection satellites, which were probably providing coverage for the no-fly zone. The remainder had little to no electronic footprint at all, so were either dead, or, if the Besquith were serious about nobody coming within 5,000 miles of the moon, were missile- or laser-equipped defense satellites.
"This was going to be a tough nut to crack," thought Alastair.
On the bright side, there did not appear to be any other warships in the system, nor, for that matter, anything in the way of interstellar shipping. Releasing his restraints, Alastair pushed off from his seat and deftly snagged the corner of Cthu's seat back before he swung his feet down to the deck and engaged his mag boots to hold him there.
"Well, we're here," said the L-Shock captain. "And from the lack of radio traffic asking about our business here, I'd say there is no system government. Mind you, the amount of electromagnetic interference created by that gas giant. Authorities may not notice our arrival.
Now what?
That's a good question,
thought Alistair, as he took in the various planets of the system floating sedately in the captain's navigation trivee. 15 moons made up the gas giant's own solar system, similar to Jupiter's back home. A bright white ring encircled the third one. That would be Cathal, then.
Well, the Cartography Guild catalog states there are no planets with a breathable atmosphere in this system.
Breathable by humans, corrected the El Shah.
I stand corrected, Captain,
said Alistair, slightly embarrassed by his inadvertent human prejudice toward races from oxygen-rich planets.
Nonetheless, Colonel,
Cthu went on, tactfully ignoring Alistair's comment.
The Karun, who originally established the mine on Cathal, were oxygen breathers like ourselves, so the nitrogen-rich atmosphere of the moon would be as unhealthy for them as it would be for ourselves. Though there are a number of species who would be equally at home in that atmosphere as we are in our own. The majority of races in the Galactic Union prefer a more oxygenated environment.
Including the Besquith guarding the research facility. Never mind the various scientists and technicians,
said Alistair, as he got an inkling of where Cthu was going with his line of thinking.
Exactly, Colonel,
Cthu stated, as he tapped a finger on another of the gas giant's moons, which expanded until it filled the majority of the trivee.
Moon 5 has an atmosphere which can sustain our form of life. The Cartography Guild don't appear to have ever got around to giving it a name. What it does have, however...
Cthu enhanced the image once more, until smudges on the surface resolved themselves into easily recognizable shapes.
Is a modern-sized settlement, complete with a couple of landing pads. If I were to hazard a guess, I would bet troops or scientists looking for R&R would be right here.
Alistair eyed the settlement's buildings, landing pads, and neat lines of agricultural fields. If they were to find a safe way onto Cathal, then a loose tongue from the settlement was their best bet.
Still, a frigate arriving in this area of space without good reason is bound to raise suspicions,
said Alistair, as his forehead wrinkled in uncertainty.
Who said we were a frigate?
The El-Shah captain said, as he turned to his tactical officer.
Select Ghost Program 3, Tactical.
Tactical tapped a command into his station, then sat back.
Ghost Program 3 engaged, sir.
Cthu looked at Alistair and chortled.
Our transponder now confirms that we are the Pylos, a Sidar trading vessel, and...
Cthu touched a control on his armrest. An image of a wiry-haired being with a large bony head and leathery wings filled the captain's trivee.
Meet Captain Yashal.
As Cthu spoke, the Sidar's mouth mirrored him. Alistair nodded appreciatively.
Impressive. I can take credit for the original idea, but the brains behind it is Dr. Wong's assistant, Laras. That Jiha is a master programmer, never mind a skilled engineer.
So, as long as you keep any visitors out of visual range, no one will suspect that a winged hussar's warship is in the vicinity,
mused Alistair.
With the range of dropships and the number of moons in orbit, I'm confident that I can keep Glambring away from prying eyes.
Replied Cthu. Alistair looked back at the small settlement hovering in the navigational display.
Let's pay it a visit, then,
said Alistair, and returned to his seat as the Glambring brought her drive online and headed for Moon 5.
Hang on back there, folks. This is going to get a little bumpy,
called the dropship pilot to his three passengers a few seconds before the entire craft seemed to drop vertically until the straining engines caught the ship and the pilots regained control. Looking around him, Alistair saw that his companions were outwardly making light of the heavy turbulence. Without warning, the entire dropship was flung violently to one side, tipping the ship up onto one wing. Alistair was pushed back into his seat, while directly above him, First Sergeant Kroll's limbs flopped loosely downwards before the dropship righted itself.
"Hell of a ride, eh, Colonel?"
Kroll grinned, as Trooper Jackson, sitting beside him, tried in vain to cover his mouth with the affectionately known barf bag before losing his breakfast onto the floor. For a moment, a feeling of regret passed over Alistair as he thought of the downcast face of Tim Buchanan when he had told the man that he would not be accompanying Alistair to the surface. Tim had been about to argue his case when Anna Wong succinctly pointed out that the medtech had recommended at least another 24 hours of nanite and regen therapy before doing any strenuous activity or risk causing more damage, which would lead to another stay in sickbay. Realizing this was an argument that he was going to lose, Tim had reluctantly withdrawn his request to accompany Alistair, but had insisted the colonel take not one, but two troopers as escort. Hence Kroll and Jackson's presence in the dropship.
"He'll not let you fly with him again if you don't clean that up, you know,"
Kroll cautioned Jackson with a half laugh. Jackson wiped his mouth with the empty barf bag.
"I'm sure the flyboys do this on purpose. It's probably a bright sunny day outside, and they are just fucking with us," he moaned.
The sound of the engines screaming lessened as the pilots eased back on the power and the dropship's flight profile smoothed off.
"We're through the worst of it now. Landing pads are in sight, and I would like to thank you all for flying winged hussars today, and look forward to seeing you again," came the jovial voice of the pilot.
"Smart ass,"
grumbled Jackson. Minutes later, the dropship touched down smooth as a feather, the engine noise dying away completely. Kroll was up and at the ramp controls, hand hovering over the release switch, as he looked to Alistair for permission. With a nod from Alistair, Kroll mashed the ramp control panel, and, with a hydraulic whine, the ramp dropped smoothly until it touched the concrete surface of the landing pad. The wind sweeping across the pad whipped up the dust into tiny dust devils, which appeared and disappeared at random. Kroll went down the ramp, and his head did a quick but thorough 360 as he searched for threats. Satisfied nothing was going to jump out and start blasting at them, he shouted over to Jackson, who was repeating Kroll's action on the far side of the dropship.
"Go see if you can scare up any transport," ordered Kroll,
having to shout to be heard over the whistling wind. Rather than shout an acknowledgement, Jackson flashed a thumbs up and jogged off to the nearest building. Alistair paused at the bottom of the ramp, looked up at the alien sky, and marveled at the complexity of the universe. The massive gas giant filled a little under half the sky at this point of Moon 5's rotation, and was close enough that it looked like you could reach out and touch it. It was massive enough that it could swallow up nearly 1,500 planets the size of Earth, and the giant hung like some malevolent being ready to unleash its fury and consume the small world that Alistair now stood upon. If that was not disconcerting enough, four more moons were visible to the naked eye. Focusing on the second most distant, Alistair tried to make out details, but Cathal was simply too distant to pick out the science-skilled research base without artificial aid.
"Everything good, Colonel?"
asked Kroll, through the thin membrane filtering out the microscopic dust particles carried in the stiff breeze. His eyes were hidden behind protective lenses.
Moon 5 may have been habitable,
but that did not mean it was a Garden of Eden. Life here was hard, but it was better than living within Cathal's atmosphere, which could kill you in minutes.
"Yeah, no problems here, Ethan,"
answered Alistair.
"And try to remember that we are prospectors working on behalf of the Cedar, looking to scope out the feasibility of setting up an F-11 extraction plant in this system. So, first names only. Understood?"
"Roger that, Colonel."
Kroll paused as he corrected himself.
"Understood, Alistair."
Using the Colonel's first name just sounded wrong to him. However, he would have to get used to it. Jackson rejoined them.
"This whole place is shut up tighter than a Kartar's bumhole."
The image of the underwater race that looked like an octopus had mated with a squid came unbidden to Alistair's mind. Dismissing it, he scanned the buildings ringing the landing pad.
"Abandoned? Or just closed up for the day, Gregor?"
By Jackson's momentary pause before answering, Alistair guessed the trooper was having the same difficulty with his colonel addressing him by his first name.
"Eh. I would say closed up rather than abandoned, eh, Alistair?"
The sound of a harrump from Kroll reached Alistair over the sound of the wind, before Jackson continued.
"I took a look in through some of the building's windows, and a few of the terminals are still on. So somebody is using them, and either forgot or didn't care about turning them off before leaving."
"Transport?"
asked Kroll. The trooper shook his head.
"Nothing."
Alistair straightened his jacket while attempting to access the local galnet. The cursor floating in his right eye continued to blink for a few seconds before a message was displayed. No local access. Alistair dismissed the message, pulling his slate from beneath his knee-length jacket and bringing up an aerial view of the settlement.
"This building here near the town center has a cluster of vehicles around it. So I vote we head there and see what we find."
"Sounds like a plan, Alistair," agreed Kroll.
Decision made. The three Scorpions headed into town. As the three men walked, Alistair was struck by how ramshackle the buildings and the street furniture were. In the modern Galactic Union, everything revolved around money, and it looked very much like that when the Red Diamond Mine had ceased operating. The majority of the population, or at least those who could afford it, simply upped sticks and left, leaving everyone who was barely scratching a living out of the ground, such as the arable farmers, to get on with it. Occasionally, the men would pass a building or home where a stray light would cast its shadow across the cracked and potholed surface of the sidewalk. There would be the fleeting image of a shadowy figure, or a muffled shout to move away from the window before the light was extinguished.
"Looks like they are not too friendly around here," said Kroll.
"Or scared of visitors," Alistair said,
as an occupant doused another light as they passed the crumbling facade of a dwelling. The town was not a large affair, emphasized by the fact it only took the Scorpions around 10 minutes to walk from the landing pads to the nominal town center. Standing with the wind tugging at his jacket, surrounded by darkened buildings, Alistair wondered if coming here had been a colossal waste of time. Then he heard a faint sound of what he generously called music, barely audible over the noise of the wind. Pulling his hood down, Alistair cupped his hands behind his ears as he strained to locate the source of the music. Satisfied he had a general direction, he recovered his head. It now had a generous amount of grit on it, which was slowly working its way down his neckline. Alistair set off in the direction of the sound, trailed by Kroll and Jackson. Going down a narrow side street, Alistair was rewarded by the sight of a blinking, gaudy neon sign, winking on and off like some distant lighthouse warning unwary mariners of an impending danger. Scattered around, seemingly at random in the street, was a variety of ground and air transport vehicles.
"This would be the building from the aerial image," surmised Alastair.
As they got closer, the music got louder, and, as the incessant wind dropped momentarily, a yelping laugh cut through the music.
Besquith. "Well, looks like we may be in the right place," said Jackson,
having to raise his voice to be heard over the resurgent wind. Alastair looked up at the blinking sign, which was randomly rotating through the multiple languages prevalent in the Union, proudly announcing the name of the establishment. Automatically, Alastair's interpretation software converted the sign to English for him. The Red Fox.
"Has to be a bar," thought Alastair,
as he wondered for a moment at the choice of name. It seemed very human. And what would a human being be doing this far out in the Union? Nobody had really been out this way since the Alpha contracts over 100 years ago. Maybe a member of another race had heard the phrase somewhere and liked the sound of it. Dismissing the thought, Alastair waved a hand for the men to follow him and covered the last few steps to the building's entrance. The exterior of the building looked as badly maintained as the rest of the town. However, the door panel glowed invitingly, and Alastair obligingly tapped it. With a whoosh, the door slid back to reveal a well-lit airlock-type affair, roughly 10 feet by 10 feet. The floor and ceiling were constructed of fine mesh, which looked like there was no way in hell it could support the weight of a grown man, never mind three. However, looks can be deceiving, and Alastair stepped confidently into the small room. Once all three men had entered, the outer door closed, shutting off the sound of the incessant wind, which only allowed the raucous music to assault their ears. From below the mesh they were standing on, strong fans whirred to life. Around them, the dust from their clothes danced in the air before being sucked away by the extraction system built into the room's ceiling.
"Well, that makes sense at least," thought Alastair.
You needed to keep the copious amounts of dust carried in the air out somehow. The fans died abruptly, their task completed, and the inner door slid to one side, allowing the deep, booming music to assault them like a physical thing. Alastair raised his arms, slipping his hood down while removing his goggles and placing them securely in a pocket. The thought of walking back to the landing pads through the mini dust storm outside without eye protection was not an appealing one. Alistair's eyes took a moment to adjust to the dimly lit interior of what was obviously a bar. At least a dozen Besquith, armed with a mix of laser and chemically propelled sidearms, were gathered around a music terminal, howling along to whatever the hell was coming from its speakers, while slurping from glass mugs full of a green liquid that looked like the rejected scum of a waste recycling plant. Alastair ran his eye over the remaining patrons of the bar, and it was your typical eclectic mix of Union races. Short-framed El Shah, multi-tentacled Bakulu, Jiha scampering across the floor holding plates of mush, which Alastair recognized as a delicacy, having seen Dr. Wong's assistant Laris devouring it back on the Glambring. There was even a sprinkling of Zool, who were either strolling around the bar on their rear legs, or had assumed their more lackadaisical quadruped method of movement. Ethan Kroll had been viewing the crowd also, and he leaned into Alastair to speak in a low voice. The loud music easily ensured that anybody not standing directly beside the two men would ever overhear their conversation. But why take chances?
"Notice how only the Besquith are armed, and
and everybody else is making a point of not making eye contact with them.
Alistair scanned the crowd again, verifying Kroll's observation.
You think the Besquith are their guy?